All right. Joel and I are very well organized and planned. And so on this beautiful day, Mother's Day, we're going to talk about evil and suffering. And so, I'll just let that linger. We've been in this series. We're wrapping it up, not today, but next Sunday, Lord willing. What in the world? We're talking about worldviews. That's something we've been talking about. How do we build a worldview? We've also even stated everyone has a worldview. We're not asking whether or not you have one. We're trying to aid you and the world. What is your worldview? And it's always not just trapped within your mind. It's lived out in your life. And so when we look at evil and suffering, it's no different. But I would say to you, it's probably the topic that brings the most confrontation in the world and perhaps even in the church of what it means to believe in God. It's a simple argument, isn't it? How can an all-powerful and an all-good God allow evil and suffering? It's all over the place, isn't it? It's a universal topic. It's not one that you're ignorant of, not one that you've not thought about. It's everywhere, and it has been everywhere. Let me share a couple of quotes. These first two quotes are from Holocaust survivors. I want you to think about this. You understand the event. I know that. You've heard about it. You've probably studied it. But I want you to think about what these two people are saying. Before you cast them out as foolish, think about what they're saying. There's Auschwitz, so there can't be God. There's Auschwitz, there can't be God. The second one, if there is a God, he will have to beg for my forgiveness. If there is a God, he will have to beg for my forgiveness. When we talk about evil and suffering, there are two components, you might say. There's a logical argument, and we'll talk about that. But there's also what you might say an existential or a personal matter. And that's probably more of what you deal with and what most people deal with. Most people aren't asking intellectually, how is it possible that there is an all-good and powerful God and allow evil and suffering? Most people aren't trying to understand that intellectually. Most people are trying to cope because they look around and their experience, they, if it's not them personally, they know somebody or they see the news, they see the world, and everyone has experienced it at some level. How do I make it when there's evil and suffering? And so when you hear these quotes, that's what they're saying. There's Auschwitz. There cannot be a God. Or if there is a God, he better beg for my forgiveness. And why are they saying that? Because a period of their life was in a place in which 1.3 million people died. People were tortured. They were experimented on. They were killed. The life expectancy was only a couple of weeks. That is what they saw. That's what they tasted. That's what they felt. And I understand that that was back then. You could say that was a while ago. Or you could think about it this way. Right now, you're minutes away from one of the largest sex trafficking cities in the world. 374 girls every month in Atlanta are exploited. Minutes from where you sit right now. It's the world that we live in. People want to know, how do we cope? And how is it possible that there is an all-good and all-powerful God when that is what is before us? I think one of the challenges for Christians is those things don't shock us anymore. They don't create those gut-wrenching stomach aches when you hear of evil. How do you know that to be true? How often are you in your office, at your home, you're driving on the road, and you hear an ambulance go by and you give no thought? Lights on an ambulance are on for a reason. Someone, somewhere, is experiencing some form of evil and suffering. But we're so in tune with that, if you're driving, you're probably frustrated. I don't want to slow down. I don't want to get over. If you're in your office or your home, you probably don't even give it a thought. It goes by and you didn't even know it. And so what I want to do this morning is I do want to help you understand the logical problem. We will talk about that. But I want you to understand the existential, the personal matter, so that we're not mindlessly living our lives, failing to see that there is evil and suffering everywhere. Not always out there. It might be right here. Could be in your own life, right in front of you. So I want to try to answer the best I can the logical problem first, and then we'll talk about the existential or personal problem. What's the logical problem? The simple statement is what I've already told you, but I want to put it in terms of what has already been publicly stated by a well-known atheist. His name is Sam Harris. This is what he says. He's looking out at the world, and he's just kind of evaluating, and he's saying there is so much evil, there is so much suffering, so there's no way there is a God. And here's his conclusion. Either God can do nothing, he doesn't care to do anything, or he doesn't exist. God is either impotent, evil, or imaginary. Take your pick and choose wisely. Do you hear what Sam Harris is saying? If there's a God, he either can't do anything, he doesn't care, or he doesn't exist. And if he does, that means he's impotent. Means he can't do something. He doesn't care, so he's evil. Or if he doesn't exist, he's imaginary. Take your pick and choose wisely. That's the argument. There's no way for an all-powerful, all-good God with so much evil and suffering. God's either not all good or he's not all powerful. Now you hear that statement and you are good Bible students. And so you understand, even when you hear that, that logical statement that Sam Harris is making is not true. Not just because you know your Bible and you believe in God, you know logically that statement is not true. Why is that statement not true? Because to have something we call objectively evil means you have to also have a standard of which you call objectively good. You cannot have something in which you define as objectively evil if there's not something opposite called objectively good. Now, that's the problem, because in our world, we're losing the category of evil. And that's what I want you to understand. When we talk about evil and suffering, we're losing in our world what is defined objectively as evil. You can find almost anything and it be somewhat tolerant to somebody. There's only one thing in the world that is consistent about what is evil: Christianity. That's the only thing in the world in which people will rally. Doesn't matter what they believe about everything else, but they will come together for that one common cause and say, Christianity is evil. Because Christians say that they have the truth, and if you don't believe it, then you are wrong. And if you are wrong, you are evil. And so when we look at the world, the category of what we mean evil, it doesn't seem to make sense anymore. And you don't even have to work hard to pick up on that, do you? Within the last 2 years, we've had a congressperson, I think it's Minnesota, Illinois, came out with public anti-Semitic statements. That was her position. Very clear. Do you know what nobody anywhere said? That's evil. Some people said this is not the right platform, which I don't know what the right one would be. Some people said that wasn't considerate. Nobody called it evil. We can take our highest office in the land. We have presidents who have looked at their life and said, nothing in my life should I have to repent for. You have a president who says, I'm religious, but unborn babies, they don't matter. Maybe you've heard this name before. Phil and I were talking about it this week. He's a Princeton professor. His name's Peter Singer. He has, for the last four presidents, meaning that current president and going back three, has been a medical advisor to the president. Do you know what Peter Singer believes and pushes for? Postpartum abortion, up to 18 months. I want you to think about that for a moment. That's a year and a half child walking, can clearly say, most likely mama or dada. And what Peter Singer is advising is, if you don't want it, don't like it, get rid of it. That's not a new phenomenon to you. We hear about abortion all the time. I've got a good pastor friend who, much more learned and read than I am, found a book, published book of two MIT professors. They happen to be male. You know what the title of their book is? The Natural History of Rape. And in it, they're going to argue that there might be a beneficial reproductive method for raping. There's nothing in the world that people call evil. Do you see how that category is being minimized over and over and over again? The only thing we're clear on that is what is evil is if you believe in God, and that being the God of the Bible. That's what Hitler taught, wasn't it? The reason why we're losing is we haven't evolved enough. We need to get our act together and try more things, do more acts of evil, and then we'll be on top. This is the world in which you and I live. Many people will call lots of different things good and lots of different things evil, but there isn't a clear consensus of what is evil and what is good. And so you see the logical problem. Or maybe we could say it this way. What's at the heart of the logical problem actually isn't a matter of evil and suffering. It's a matter of righteousness and justice. We call that a theodicy. You've probably heard that term before. It's two words being put together. Theos, God, and dikaiosyne, which is righteousness. What they're questioning is God good and righteous? If God is righteous, then there can't be evil. But you see, that logical problem falls on its head then, isn't it? Or doesn't it? They're saying because evil and suffering exist, there can't be a God. And we're actually saying, no, because evil and suffering exists, there is a God. That is the proof that there is a God. Because you cannot make a statement and say something is evil without making a moral judgment. Evil is not a scientific term, and neither is suffering. Suffering is natural. Evil is a moral judgment. And so what people are doing are making moral judgments. And where does morality come from? God. The reason why we are moral or lack of morality is because there is a God. And so we've talked about this a little bit before. That's why true biblical Christians don't believe in atheists. There's no such thing as an atheist. That's what Paul is saying, isn't he, in Romans 1. Everyone has the truth of God being implanted, not just in their DNA because they're image bearers, but upon their heart. And so we don't call them atheists or agnostics. One pastor, I like what he calls them. He calls them anti-theists. It means that they hate God and they do everything that they can to not believe in what he has said. It's not that they don't. That's natural to them. They have to suppress that truth, what Paul in Romans 1 will tell you. And so what we're talking about is why is there so much hatred towards God? How does evil and suffering exist with a good God? Well, Job is a good friend, isn't he? Job helps us. I won't make you turn there. But one of the challenges, one conclusion you could draw from the book of Job is simply, when Job decides to question God, you answer me, God, and we talked about that, how God responds to Job. It didn't go so well for Job at that moment. But what was God doing in his response to Job? What he's saying to Job is, Job, if you weren't there, and if you can't comprehend what I do in the physical world, how I have created it, you and everything else, how are you going to understand how I distribute good and evil? And that's the answer to the moral or the logical problem. They don't believe that there is a morally sufficient reason that God has for evil. That is a logical answer, but a very challenging one to understand. To believe that God has a morally sufficient reason for evil and suffering. You can say that quite quickly, but it is very hard to plummet steps. And why? Because there's an unfathomable reason. When we think about the God of the Bible, that he is all good, he is all powerful, and he could stop it, and he doesn't. And you and I ask, why? And the answer? I don't know. I don't know. We know the logical argument doesn't work because the answer is he has a morally sufficient reason. But the problem with answering the logical argument is that a God you want to worship? At the end, when they hear that God can have a morally sufficient reason, it doesn't spur them on to want to worship that God. But perhaps they're not actually asking the logical reason. Maybe they're actually asking the personal one, the existential one. How do I cope with it? If I need to hide an intellectual argument, I'll hide there. But how do I cope with it? Because you know what they don't have an answer for? Is why should they be good? If there is no God, why should they be good? Why should you help oppressed people? Why should you help children? Why should you try to correct or fix any kind of injustice? What's your reason? What's your rationale? How do you have a sufficient reason for that if there's not a good and benevolent God? If you don't believe in God, there is no good reason for you to do that. There, you don't have a Darwinian concept that says, yes, seek the good. When you read about survival of the fittest, you've never seen seek the good. It's called seek me and whatever I can do. And so the logical problem will always fail, but it doesn't help us understand why do we worship or why should we worship. So what about the existential? What about the personal problem? It means that evil and suffering is not a general challenge. It's a personal one. It's not just out there. It's in here for sure, but it's also right in front of me. How do I deal with what is evil and what is suffering in front of me? People look at their own lives. Why did my parents get divorced? Well, why did God take my child from me? Why have we lost our house or job? Why am I losing friends? You could go on. Why? And what people are saying in their hearts without confessing with their mouths is, Lord, save me, help me, do something different, make my life, circumstances different. I don't want to experience such evil and suffering. Do something in which my life gets better. But when God doesn't answer, and they don't hear, this is why I'm doing it. Or this is what I'm going to do. Or I'm going to change your circumstance. People really have a hard time, don't they? And so what are we looking at in a personal problem of evil and suffering? As you know, when you experience it or when you see it, you say things like, I don't like it. I can't stand it. That's not right. That's wrong. And in fact, at most of the time, you probably say, I hate that. And I want you to understand how biblical of a statement that is. When you look at evil and suffering in your life and in the life in the world, and you say, I hate it, you're on good grounds. Because God hates things. Did you know that? The reason why you hate evil and suffering is because there, in fact, is a God. And He hates evil. And He hates suffering. And so how do we deal with that? What does that mean? Well, we see it most clearly in the person of Jesus. Let me read just a short passage to you. I'm not going to dissect everything that's in here. I just want to help you see how much God hates things. You ready? John chapter 11. When she, that is Martha, had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here, teacher meaning Jesus, and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there, the tomb of Lazarus. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? What do we see in Jesus? It's that short verse that everyone tells you you should memorize, that you already had memorized and you didn't know the reference to. Jesus wept. I need you to understand something. That's recorded not as like some docetic statement of symbolism. Doceticism says that Jesus only appeared to be physical, but he was really just, it was some kind of weird spiritual manifestation, but he never suffered, never experienced anything. He didn't actually have a human body. So when he dies on the cross, it just seems like he's doing something. He's giving us a model. That's not what John is saying. What does John say? Jesus saw that they were sad, that they were weeping. He, in his spirit, was greatly troubled, and he wept. Real tears, real ugly sobbing tears down your Savior's face. Because it came from a real thought of real evil distress. He looks at his friend, and his friend is dead. He is not breathing. He is not even in front of him. He's in a tomb. And Jesus weeps because he hates sin. And that wasn't the first realization for Jesus that he hated sin. He's not just seeing or hearing that Lazarus is dead and is wondering, well, this is what the effects of sin are. Jesus was standing in the garden when Adam decided to plunge humanity into sin. And from Genesis 3 all the way on, knows the destructiveness of sin and says he hates it. And he weeps over it. And then he provides the greatest news ever to you. Because he doesn't just weep. He then raises him. And says, that is not the life that I have come to give to my people. They were created in my image not to live and die, but to live eternally. And you see it in the life of Lazarus. It's a powerful picture, isn't it? That God hates sin. And he's willing to do something about it. Now, how does that help you and me? The writer to Hebrews is very helpful. I guess it was last week. We had the young professionals over at our house, and I was doing a, you know, injustice to the text for sure, but a short devotion on Hebrews chapter 1. You know, we talked about Hebrews 11, had a long sermon series. And I was saying, I wanted you to know where did this sermon, as it were, from Hebrews start? Hebrews 1, and what's the author trying to tell you? Jesus is supreme. He is superior. He is greater than everything you can imagine, anything that you can ask for. And he's gonna start taking verses and chapters by telling you, that, let me show you how good he is. Let me show you how great he is. But then he's going to get to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, he's going to say some things that are a little bit interesting. And Jesus is able to help you. Help me when we are tempted. When we face temptations, Jesus is able to help us when we are tempted because he was tempted like we were, and yet was without sin. And that should blow your minds enough. But the author of Hebrews is saying, no, you haven't gone far enough. You haven't gone deep enough. You don't understand what I'm telling you about how good and how great Jesus is. He's not just a king, a prophet, and a priest. He doesn't just understand your temptations because he was tempted himself. You get to Hebrews chapter 4 and you learn something incredible about your God. Do you know what you learn in Hebrews chapter 4? Maybe I'll say it this way. Do you know what you don't learn in Hebrews chapter 4? You have a God in heaven who cannot and does not empathize with you. Did you know that? God's never in heaven, nor Jesus, the Trinity. They're never looking down and scratching their head thinking, you know, I wonder what it's like. If that happened to me, that would really make me mad, sad, distressed, depressed. God does not empathize with his people. Do you know what he does? He sympathizes. He doesn't have to wonder what it's like because he experienced it. That's what Hebrews 4 tells you. Is Jesus, your high priest, is able to sympathize with your weakness. You're not walking around hoping that Jesus understands what it's like to be you. He knows far better what it's like to be you, or far more, we could say, than what it's like to be you. That's the God of the Bible. And only Christianity can provide answers for that. Only Christianity says God suffers. The rest of the world, all other worldviews, all other religions, they're not honest or realistic about this problem of evil and suffering. Sometimes they'll tell you it exists, but they give you no solution. Sometimes they tell you it's just a figment of your imagination. You don't act, there's no real evil and suffering, it's just how you think about it. Only Christianity aids you in understanding that because there's evil and suffering, God himself dealt with it personally. He sees the seriousness of it, and he deals with it personally. And it's so big to him, he doesn't just deal with it personally, he gets involved intimately. And he gives his life. And what you are to understand, what am I to understand on the cross? It's not just a picture of a new life that's coming when Jesus is raised from the dead. What you're getting is a present reality of a future judgment. This is what God's going to do against all evil and all suffering. I am going to punish it relentlessly. I will not give up. It will not end. Hell is a real place. And God is saying, every time you see judgments like that in earth, I'm giving you a reminder, there will be a day that is to come, and I will wipe out every evil and every suffering. And it's meant to drive you and me to the cross and to say, he knows what he's doing. Be patient. His work's not done. He will return, and he will care for all of your needs, and he will judge all of what is unholy, what is unrighteous. So what do we do with a topic like that? I think we have to first admit we're asking the wrong question. It's not about evil and suffering. We ask questions like, what if bad things happen to good people? What if bad things happen to good people? Actually, rather, what we should be asking, what if good things happen to sinners? What if good things happen to people who hate God? Why would God show mercy ever? Why would he show us grace ever? Why doesn't more evil exist? Why isn't there more suffering? That was one thing that we were talking about with the youth. That's the greatness of God. When we talk about no God, you understand if God withdraws his hand. When we say total anarchy, we don't have an understanding of what that looks like. Seattle doesn't help you with that. Seattle even created their own laws. It doesn't help you. When God removes himself, it's only murder, only thief, only killing, only hardship all the time. There is no good without God. And that's what Christianity is telling you, is if God is not present, you do not know or understand anything about what is good. And so when we say, how do bad things happen to good people? It's the wrong question. Why do good things happen to sinners? Why does God ever show us mercy? One challenge. I'll finish with this. Maybe we have a moment for a question or two. All hard questions go to Joel. I think one of the challenges that happen in the church at times, but probably when people are trying to cope. You know, you Christians talk about how God is good and he saves people. What about those people who come to Christ in their death? They were notoriously terrible people. All of what we know about him is bad and evil. How could God save them? How could they go to heaven? The hard answer is simply this. We have so compared ourselves to each other. We get our morality from one to one. And we say, the reason why that guy gets to go, or the reason why he shouldn't go, is because I'm a pretty good person and that person's not. We have to understand, when we talk about moral people, there's no such thing as a moral person. There's no such thing as a moral person. You could strive for morality, but it's not real. Because you and I are evil at the core of who we are. That is what sin has done to us. So there's no such thing as a moral person. That is the good news of the gospel. As it turns that kind of a statement, it changes entirely the expectations. That is what the gospel is going to say, is not why do good people go to hell. What is bad people, or any person for that matter, go to heaven? The gospel changes all of our expectations by saying, I took the punishment of all the evil and suffering, and I will make it right. That is how you and I live. And that's the advantage we have with Job. You see, when you read the book of Job, you only have a slight advantage to him. Job didn't get to read chapter 1 and 2. He doesn't get to know about this conversation that God and Satan are having. You and I know that. But do you know what? By the end of the book, you and I are sitting shoulder to shoulder with Job. We don't know. And so we put our hands over our mouth. We're like, my eyes can't see and my mind can't understand. I might even say we're blind. But faith offers sight. Not a wishful faith. Not a faith that it tries to escape reality. But faith that's rooted in a promise. That God will make all things right. And when we forget, we look at the cross as not just the demonstration, but the declaration. I will come again. And I will bring you home. And you will be my people. And I will take care of all the evil.
Stop there. See if there's any questions.